During the last 2 years, 2 or 3 years, our nation, the United States of America, has been in greater danger than ever before in its history. You and I, American people, have been in greater danger. Never before has there been the possibility that all the American people might be killed, or that the United States would cease to exist as a nation. Yet that is our situation now. Because of the existence in the world of great stockpiles of nuclear weapons, which could destroy our nation, all of the great cities, which could kill the American people, there exists this possibility. I think that the danger is going to be less in the future than it has been during the recent past, but there is a possibility that the danger will continue to increase and that it will culminate in the catastrophe of nuclear war that will bring death to all of us and to all of the Russian people and the people in Europe generally, and will mean the end of the United States and the end of the USSR and the end of the European nations as nations, perhaps the end of civilization. I think that whether or not the danger continues to increase for us will be determined by the actions that we take and the actions that our government takes, the actions taken by the governments of the world in collaboration with one another. I am optimistic. I think that we are going to work hard enough to see to it that our nation is not destroyed, that the danger that we are in now does not continue, that we make the world a safer place for us and for our children and for our nation. That is what I believe. But I believe that we are going to have to work in order to achieve this end. You know what the situation is in the world, the great change that occurred in the world in 1945 and then again in 1954. Let me summarize the nature of these changes. In 1945, we exploded the first atomic bombs. Bombs were exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, each of which killed 100,000 people or more, destroyed a city. Hiroshima was smashed flat over an area 2 miles in diameter. This was the first great discontinuity in the ways of waging war. The Hiroshima bomb had the explosive energy of 20,000 tons of TNT, 20,000 one-ton blockbusters. It became evident immediately that it would be only rational for war to be abandoned as the means of settling disputes between nations. Professor Einstein, Albert Einstein, pointed out that war had become so terrible in 1945 because of the development of atomic bombs that no nation could hope to benefit any longer from waging war fought with these terrible weapons. He said, "Now a single bomb can destroy a city such as Minneapolis in the way that Hiroshima was destroyed. One bomb could kill most of the people in this city. It no longer makes sense to attempt to settle disputes between nations by waging war." I don't know whether or not war would have been given up if we had remained in the atomic bomb state for 20 years. I think that we were fortunate that before 10 years had gone by, we moved into the next state. On the 1st of March, 1954, the United States exploded the first super bomb. This bomb, called the Bravo bomb, was exploded at Bikini. There had been some test explosions carried out of hydrogen bombs before that time, but we carried out the explosion of the first super bomb, and since then the USSR and Great Britain have exploded super bombs. The super bombs are the standard weapons now of the great nuclear powers. The Bikini Bomb was a three-stage bomb, as are the other super bombs. Its first stage consisted of a few pounds of plutonium, like the Hiroshima bomb, which, when it exploded, liberated energy equal to that of 20,000 tons of TNT and produced a temperature of tens of millions of degrees, perhaps as high as 50 million degrees. At this high temperature, the material of the second stage of the bomb, about 200 pounds of lithium deuteride, underwent the fusion reaction. The first stage in this bomb was the fission of the nuclei of plutonium. The second stage, the fusion, the combining together of the nuclei of the lithium and deuterium atoms in the lithium deuteride. This liberated a tremendous amount of energy and a very great number of neutrons, which then caused the third stage to take place. The third stage was the fission reaction in the nuclei of about 1,000 pounds of ordinary uranium metal. The materials in the bomb cost altogether about $85,000, and the gadgetry, I don't know how much, but these bombs are pretty cheap. The explosion of this three-stage bomb in a period of a millionth of a second liberated the energy equivalent of 20 million tons of TNT. This one bomb was 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb or the Nagasaki bomb, equal to 20 million one-ton blockbusters. That is 7 times the explosive energy of all of the explosives used in the whole of the Second World War. One of these bombs exploded over New York would smash the city flat, destroy it over an area about 20 miles in diameter. It would set houses on fire, wooden houses on fire, in an area 40 miles in diameter, and cause a great firestorm, which would rage for days and would suffocate anybody who was in shelters in underneath or in the basements or cellars of buildings underneath this region of perhaps 40 miles in diameter. And in addition, the radioactive materials of the bomb would cause great damage. I think that I should like to say a few words about the radioactive substances that are produced when an atomic bomb explodes, because I believe that the hope that we have for the future may be attributed to the fact that it has been recognized by people all over the world, everywhere now, that even the testing of an atomic bomb does damage to human beings all over the world. So far, there have been about 250 atomic bombs tested. Most of these were small bombs, like the Hiroshima or Nagasaki bomb, 100,000 person bombs. But some dozen or so have been great bombs, like the Bikini bomb, the Bravo bomb that we exploded in 1954. The amount of explosive energy in the bomb tests has been 180 megatons, 180 million tons equivalent. That's 60 times the explosive power of all explosives used in the whole of the Second World War. But this is only the testing of a few representative bombs similar to those that are piled up in the stockpiles of the great nuclear powers, the United States, USSR, and Great Britain. When fission occurs in the first and third stages of a great bomb, the nuclei of plutonium or of uranium-235 or uranium-238, ordinary uranium, results in the manufacture of nuclei that are about half the size of these heavy nuclei. These nuclei are unstable. They are highly radioactive. They decompose, sending out powerful rays which can damage people and do damage people. These rays, for example, the gamma rays from cesium-137, pass through the bodies of human beings all over the world and damage their reproductive organs in such a way as to cause gene mutations. These gene mutations result in the birth of defective children. About 4% of the children who are born in the world have gross physical or mental defects, largely for congenital reasons, in considerable part caused by high-energy radiation. Some of this damage is due to cosmic rays and natural radioactivity. Some of it is due to other causes that haven't been tracked down yet. Some of it now is due to irradiation of the reproductive organs by medical x-rays in the course of diagnostic or therapeutic use of medical x-rays. This is very valuable, of course. The use of x-rays for medical purposes has been a boon to mankind. But we have to recognize also that the x-rays are dangerous and do harm in causing genetic defects, causing defective children to be born, and in causing cancer. Now, part of the damage that is being done now to the pool of human germplasm is genetic damage caused by fallout radioactivity, radioactive materials produced by the fission of plutonium and uranium in the bomb tests, during the bomb tests carried out during the last 15 years. The estimate that I have used, which is one that is due essentially to the American scientists of the Committee of the National Academy of Sciences and National Research Council, and to the scientists of 19 countries who constituted the United Nations Committee on Radioactive Fallout and its effects on man, is that the explosion of one great bomb, such as the Bikini bomb, can be expected to damage the pool of human germplasm in such a way that 15,000 children will be born with gross physical or mental defect during the next generation and the following few generations as a result of the action of the radioactive fission products. And that, in addition, the carbon-14 radioactive form of carbon that is produced by the neutrons liberated in the explosion of the bomb will cause about 150,000 children to be born with gross physical or mental defect over a period, however, of a great many generations. Carbon-14 has a mean life of 8,000 years. The carbon-14 liberated in the bomb tests has piled up in the atmosphere so that the concentration of this radioactive material is now 15% greater than it was in 1954. Some carbon-14 is produced by cosmic rays. We are damaged to some extent by this carbon-14. Now the amount of carbon-14 is 15% greater than it was a few years ago because of the bomb tests. Now, you can understand why I agree with Bertrand Russell in his statement that the pollution of the atmosphere with radioactive materials is the most wicked thing that we have ever done. One bomb test, the testing of one great nuclear bomb, can be expected to cause 15,000 children to be born with gross physical or mental defect in the next generation and few succeeding generations, and 10 times that number over a long period of time, and also to cause similar numbers of people to die of cancer. Leukemia, bone cancer, cancer of the thyroid, and other forms of cancer who would otherwise have remained in good health until they reached a period when their death would occur from other reasons. These estimates that one great bomb causes tens or hundreds of thousands of people to die of cancer, and the similar number, 10,000 to 100,000 people, children to be born with gross physical or mental defect, these estimates are reliable estimates, and there is no dissension among scientists as to their reliability. There is, of course, a difference of opinion among scientists as to whether it is justified to carry out the testing of nuclear bombs when we recognize that the testing is accompanied by this damage to human beings and to the human race. I myself think that now that the great stockpiles of nuclear weapons exist in the world, there is no justification for any further bomb tests, whatever the justification may have been during the past 15 years when we had the not-so-great understanding of the consequences as we have now. There are some scientists who say that the United States must stay strong, stronger than Russia, that we must continue to be in a position where we can enforce our national will on the rest of the world. There are without doubt scientists in Russia who say that Russia must stay or become stronger than any other nation in the world and to be in a position to continue by force to enforce her national will on the rest of the world. I myself do not agree. I feel that a policy of reliance on the powers of destruction, followed by two great nations, the United States and the USSR, is surely going to lead to catastrophe. That the only safety that exists in the world for us today is the safety of international law and of careful disarmament with controls and inspection. The safety that comes from applying to the actions of nations the same principles of justice and morality that we accept for ourselves as individual human beings. Now, we have had for nearly a year and a half a discussion going on in Geneva among the United States, the USSR, and Great Britain, the United States represented by Ambassador Wadsworth, USSR by Ambassador Tsarapkin, and Great Britain by Ambassador Wright, on the formulation of an agreement to stop the testing of all nuclear weapons all over the world for all time. An agreement that in the course of time would, we may hope, be signed by all of the nations in the world. It is fine that these negotiations are underway, have been underway for nearly a year and a half, and I believe that it is fine that they have been conducted with great care and not in haste. I think that we need to be assured, and that the USSR needs to be assured, that the agreement, when it is finally formulated, is a proper one, that there are no loopholes in it for either the United States and Great Britain or the USSR, that there is nothing significant that has been overlooked, that it gives the maximum assurance to us that the bomb test agreement will be kept. This agreement must be made. It will, however, be only the first step. It must be followed by other agreements that decrease the chance that the nuclear weapons, the bombs that now exist in the stockpiles of the world, will be used in a great nuclear war that could destroy the world. I should like to discuss the nature of nuclear war, and especially the significance of radioactivity in a nuclear war. The nuclear weapons that exist in the stockpiles of the world now are called dirty bombs. They have the third stage, these great nuclear weapons, the third stage of fission of 1,000 pounds of uranium metal that produces a tremendous amount of highly radioactive fission products. These fission products are extremely radioactive during the first few hours after they have been produced by the detonation of the bomb. When a bomb test is carried out, the effort is made to have the radioactive fission products drop into the ocean or into the desert where only a few people will be damaged by them, or go up into the stratosphere. In the stratosphere, these radioactive fission products remain for a year or two or three years, gradually leaking down into the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, and then being brought to the surface of the Earth by rain. When this occurs, after the period of a few years, most of the radioactive substances have undergone decomposition and are no longer harmful. But some of them still are harmful. Cesium-137 and strontium-90 are the perhaps the most important ones of the harmful elements in the worldwide fallout. It is the worldwide fallout that I have been talking about that causes damage to people and to the human race as a result of the bomb tests. However, There is another kind of fallout that occurs and that would be of great importance in a nuclear war. This is the local fallout. If a great bomb were to be exploded over New York, the blast and fire and immediate radiation effects could be expected to kill most of the people in an area 20 miles in diameter, or perhaps even 40 miles in diameter, depending upon how great the firestorm was that raged over this larger area. This means that in an area of perhaps 400 square miles or 800 square miles, there would be little hope for anyone to survive. Even if there were shelters, there would be little hope for anyone to survive because the oxygen would all be used up by the firestorm and people would suffocate in their shelters after a few hours or a day or two. However, the danger, the damage done by the explosion of a great nuclear bomb is much greater than indicated by this description that I have given so far. In the case of a ground burst, so-called, when the explosion occurs within a mile or two of the surface of the Earth and the fireball reaches the Earth, the fireball is perhaps 4 miles in diameter. It has the temperature of the sun. This great fireball would sweep up thousands of tons of earth and other materials into itself and vaporize them, vaporize the concrete and steel of buildings. This material and the soil, this material as it then condensed as the fireball expanded, would entrap a large part, 80% of the radioactive fission products, and the condensed material, the droplets and condensed particles, would fall to Earth within an hour or two in the region around the site of the explosion. After the Bikini bomb exploded, a cigar-shaped region, roughly cigar-shaped, about 50 miles wide and 200 miles long, was heavily contaminated with the local radioactive fallout. In general, one says that an area of about 10,000 square miles would be heavily contaminated with local radioactive fallout within an hour or two after the explosion of a 20-megaton bomb, the standard weapons. Now, the amount of irradiation to which human beings in this area would on the average be exposed during the first day is 20 times that necessary to cause them to die in a few days of acute radiation sickness. They become nauseated and feverish and begin to hemorrhage internally and die within a few days as a result of this exposure, or within a few hours if they have received many times the lethal dose. There is time enough, of course, for them to press the buttons to get off the retaliatory attack, but they still would die. There's even time, even if they have been exposed to this radiation, time for them to get in their great bombers and fly over Russia and drop the retaliatory bombs that would destroy Russia. But they would die unless they were able in some way to escape. People in the Rocky Mountains, some sections of the Rocky Mountains, regions where where there was no reason for bombs to fall, might well escape. There might be some millions of Americans who would survive a nuclear attack. I have talked about the effect of one bomb. If there were to be a bomb dropping on New York, it would kill perhaps 10 million people, one bomb. In fact, if it dropped on Philadelphia and the wind were blowing toward New York, it would not only destroy Philadelphia, but the radioactive fallout might well kill everybody in New York. Actually, of course, there are plenty of bombs, so that there would be some bombs for Philadelphia as well as for New York. I have calculated that 300 20-megaton bombs would be enough to kill everybody in the United States. The area of the United States is 3 million square miles, and at 10,000 square miles per bomb, 300 bombs would do the job. 300 would kill everybody, nearly everybody in the USSR. 4,000 would be enough to kill everybody on Earth if the bombs were detonated rather uniformly over the land surfaces of the Earth. I have also calculated from available information that the United States now has 100,000 bombs in its stockpile, and that the USSR has 50,000. Many of these bombs are small bombs, 100,000 people bombs like Hiroshima-Nagasaki bombs, but I am sure that many thousands of them are the great megaton bombs, 20 megaton bombs, the 10 million person bombs, such as our Bikini bomb, the Bravo bomb, and I am sure that the United States has many more bombs than necessary to kill everybody on Earth, and that the USSR has more than necessary to kill everybody on Earth. There have been a number of analyses made of hypothetical attacks, nuclear attacks, surprise attacks on the United States. In these studies, for example, 3 years ago, Dr. Kellogg of the RAND Corporation testified before the Special Subcommittee on Radiation of the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy about some of the surveys that the RAND Corporation has made of hypothetical nuclear attacks on the United States. He discussed in detail one small nuclear attack involving 250 bombs, 250, 5, 10, and 20 megaton bombs. These bombs were all assumed to be so-called dirty bombs. The clean bombs, by the way, produce much more carbon-14 than the dirty bombs, and the testing of a clean bomb does more damage to the human race in the long run than the testing of the dirty bombs. We know how to make the so-called clean bombs, which do not have the third stage of fission, but they are not stockpiled because they are not effective enough in war. They do not produce the local fallout that would permit one 20 megaton bomb to kill most of the people in an area of 10,000 square miles. So that it is the dirty bombs that exist in the nuclear stockpiles and that would be used. Dr. Kellogg's information was to the effect that the attack with 250, 5 megaton, 10 megaton, and 20 megaton bombs would cause 86 million Americans to be killed, 25 million to be seriously injured, and the remainder to be more or less damaged by fallout. Now, a 250 bomb attack is a small nuclear attack. We have 1,850 B-47s and B-52s in our SAC. Each of them can carry at least one 20 megaton bomb. There is no reason why we should not make an attack on the USSR with these planes alone. That would be a 1,000 20 megaton bomb attack, not a 250 20 megaton bomb attack. We have rocket bases in England and other countries, Thor rockets that can carry a megaton bomb warhead. How many, I don't know. Perhaps 1,000 of these great weapons could be lobbed over into Russia to kill the Russian people and destroy the Russian cities. This is called overkilling, of course, because 300 would be enough probably to kill everybody in Russia. There are enough bombs in the world to kill everybody on Earth. In particular, the United States and the USSR would surely be destroyed. There are not enough bombs to prevent retaliation. If 200 or 400 or 600 or 1,000 great bombs were dropped on the United States by the USSR, there would be an area of a few hundred square miles around the site of explosion of each one where everyone would be killed and all the installations and structures would be destroyed. But there are not enough bombs to destroy in this way the whole United States. Most of the area, 96% of the area, would remain undamaged except by fallout, which would kill the people in the course of time. In the meantime, the retaliation could take place. President Eisenhower has said, even if there were to be a great surprise nuclear attack on the United States, we could still destroy Russia completely. And Mr. Khrushchev has said, even if there were to be a great surprise nuclear attack on the USSR, we could still destroy the USSR completely. And both of them are right. And they both know that Both of these statements are right, and this is why both the USSR and the United States, through their governments, are working so hard to obtain some satisfactory, acceptable international agreements to control these nuclear weapons, to prevent them from being used. Well, this is our situation now. There exist in the world weapons that can destroy the world. Unless we get control of these weapons and prevent their use in a nuclear war, the United States will end as a nation, the USSR will end as a nation, you and I will be dead. We can feel happy that for nearly 2 years the policy of the United States has been to work for an agreement to stop the testing of nuclear weapons, to be followed by other agreements to obtain control of the nuclear stockpiles and to lead to disarmament. And this has been the policy of the USSR too. Great progress has been made. The United States has made concessions, and the USSR has made concessions. The nuclear bomb test agreement is now nearly completed, and we can be, I feel, confident that if we all continue to work to the end of making this agreement, it will be achieved. We must then work to get the agreement signed by other powers, France, Sweden, other powers in the world, and especially, of course, China. I believe that unless something is done, China will detonate a nuclear weapon within 2 years, 1962, and will have a good-sized stockpile of great bombs by 1965. I think that the only rational course for us to follow about China, for the world to follow about China, is to recognize China, the Chinese People's Republic, as a part of the community of nations of the world, to admit her to the United Nations, give her a seat on the Security Council, and, perhaps in return, get her to sign on the dotted line about bomb tests and the construction of nuclear weapons. Otherwise, we shall have, before many years have gone by, another great nuclear power that will increase the chance of outbreak of a nuclear war and of world destruction. I believe that we need to make an international agreement. All of these international agreements must be with the best possible systems of inspection and control. We need to make an international agreement to stop the manufacture of more and more nuclear weapons. We are in the overkill stage already. Also, to stop the manufacture of the vehicles to deliver the nuclear weapons. These vehicles are the intercontinental ballistic missiles and the shorter range rockets, and also the supersonic bombers. An agreement to stop the manufacture of these vehicles will be more easily checked than an agreement to stop the manufacture of the bombs themselves. And this, I think, is very important. Then, of course, I believe that we need to have international agreements that permit a cessation of the waste of a large part of the goods, the available materials of the world, on weapons. This is a pure waste. These armaments can't be used. They would just lead to world destruction, and yet we are altogether in the world spending about $100 billion a year on this purpose. I am opposed also to the wasting of funds on bomb shelters, fallout shelters, and on civil defense in general. I know that Governor Rockefeller advocates that $4 million be spent to build a shelter for 640 key state employees in Albany. That's $6,000 per person. If a bomb, of course, hit above the shelter, the shelter would not have done any good. If the bomb did not hit above the shelter, and if the shelter is provided with a source of oxygen so that the people in the south shelter were not suffocated in case that a fire were raging above, then the shelter might provide some protection. In fact, I believe that if similar shelters were to be built for all of the American people, at a cost of something over $100 billion, then it might be possible, in case of a nuclear war, to save the lives of 10 or 20 million Americans who got into these shelters. Instead of having perhaps 5 million survivors, there might be 25 million survivors after a great nuclear attack, and with a correspondingly increased chance of rebuilding civilization. All of the cities would be destroyed. All of the people in the cities killed. It would be only a fraction of the people who live in the rural regions in the countries, and especially the Rocky Mountain region, who would survive. All of the industries would be destroyed. They would have to be rebuilt. Whether the United States could rebuild itself then, I don't know. But I believe that to save 25 million rather than 5 million Americans in a nuclear war should not be our goal. Our goal should be to save the whole 180 million Americans, and we can do that if we spend our money and our effort to prevent nuclear war, rather than to save a few percent of the American people. I am opposed to the expenditure of $100 billion or $15 billion or any sum of money on shelters, because I believe that this increases the chance of nuclear war rather than decreasing it. It has been pointed out by Herman Kahn, Mr. Kahn, one of the RAND Corporation scientists, that in their studies they consider the nuclear stockpiles of the United States to be a deterrent of three kinds. First, a deterrent of war, deterrent of nuclear attack. I believe that it is fine that these nuclear stockpiles exist and are a deterrent of war, of aggression, armed aggression, because if they did not exist, I feel that a third world war would be inevitable. I think it is the existence, the development, and existence of these nuclear weapons that makes it essential that we give up war. Now, the second use of the nuclear stockpiles by the United States is as a deterrent of gross political action, and the third use as a deterrent of minor political action on the part of the USSR. I believe that it is the use of nuclear stockpiles as a threat to prevent political action, that endangers the United States more than anything else in the world. There are people who want to have us continue to use our nuclear stockpile as a threat to prevent political action, as a factor in our foreign affairs, a way of settling disputes by the threat of force and destruction. And I'm sure that there are people in the USSR who want to have this procedure followed in the future, too, by the USSR. I can quote an example. When, a few months ago, Mr. Khrushchev visited the United States, there were advertisements in, full-page advertisements, in the New York Times, the Portland Oregonian, and many other newspapers, advertisements with a great one-inch-wide black border, saying, "Let there be no deals with Khrushchev." These advertisements, which opposed settling disagreements between the United States and the USSR in a rational way by discussion and arbitration, these advertisements were paid for by the Allen Bradley Company of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a defense contractor, manufacturer of electronic components, because I suppose the Allen Bradley Company, the people of the Allen Bradley Company, think that it is better to continue to use threat as a way to get our way in the world instead of relying upon reason, working for justice, instead of avoiding war, we might continue to threaten to wage war. Mr. Kahn pointed out that if we were to spend $100 billion on a system of shelters, then the USSR would either be forced to match this expenditure by spending an equal sum on a system of shelters for the Russian people, or to accept a position of inferiority to the United States, or perhaps to initiate the attack on the United States immediately. And it may well be that an action of this sort, the expenditure of these great sums on shelters by the United States, would lead to the outbreak of the nuclear war that would destroy the United States. I can give as an illustration of the people in the United States who are, I think, really our greatest enemies, and of the people in other countries, too, in the same category, the people whom I fear most of all, Mr. Gerhard D. Bleichen. Mr. Bleichen is the vice president and secretary of the John Hancock Mutual Life Insurance Company and a member of the National Academy of Sciences Advisory Committee on Civil Defense. I am a member of the Academy of Political Science, which has its headquarters here at Columbia University, and I read the Political Science Quarterly. In the Political Science Quarterly for December 1959, Mr. Bleichen had an article about the daring use of spiritual, political, psychological, and military force, including our capacity to wage varying types of war successfully in order to preserve peace and our way of life. He pointed out that our strategy of deterrence is based squarely on the enemy's fear of massive destruction. And, of course, the USSR's policy has been based squarely on our fear of massive destruction, and I think that it is good that we both recognize, both the United States and the USSR, together with other nations in the world, that the danger of destruction of the world in case that a war were to break out is so great that it no longer makes sense to consider having a war. We have to plan for something else. This is what I believe. However, Mr. Bleichen goes on to say that not only do we have the capacity to destroy Russia in a nuclear war, but that the United States would continue as a nation even after the nuclear war. He says, America must be hardened so that if nuclear war comes and millions are killed, if millions more are sick and dying of radiation exposure, if the nation is fragmented into islands of survival with only remnants of federal and state and local authority, if food, power, and transportation are inadequate, if commands are confusing and conflicting, if invasions occur or are expected, if final annihilation is expected momentarily by those who have thus far survived, then the incredibly difficult mission would be not only for the military to prosecute the war successfully, but for the civilian survivors to pull the United States together and start the long process of rebuilding it segment by segment into a nation. Safety, Mr. Bleichen says, safety does not lie in abandoning our capacity to wage nuclear war, but only in improving it, in making it more real, in making the threat a greater factor in our foreign policy, and in the capacity to enforce our national will. Mr. Bleichen thinks that we should use our nuclear stockpile as a threat in our foreign policy, in achieving the ends that we think desirable, that we should use it to enforce our national will upon the rest of the world, to enforce our national will. And there are, without doubt, people in the USSR who think that the USSR should use the capacity of the USSR to wage nuclear war, to make the threat a greater factor in the foreign policy of the USSR and in the capacity of the USSR to enforce her national will. What would happen to the world if Mr. Blyken and people of his way of thinking were to win out in the struggle that is now going on in the United States, or if his analog in the USSR and if his analog in the USSR were to win out in the struggle that, with little doubt, is also going on in the USSR? The struggle of selfishness and immorality against morality and reason. I believe that we are going to win out, we who believe that morality is important in the world, that the time has come now when we can get rid of the great immorality of war, the plague that has plagued the world for thousands of years, that has caused death and suffering and destruction for generation after generation. It seemed only a few years ago, 20 years ago, that war with its death and suffering and destruction was an inevitable part of the nature of the world, that it would be impossible to eliminate it, that the forces of reason, the power of reason, was not great enough to win out over whatever powers of evil it is that had caused war to arise as one of the institutions that continued century after century. Now, because of the development of these great nuclear weapons and because of the existence of these great stockpiles of nuclear weapons, such that if a great war were to break out, the world would be largely destroyed, civilization might well come to an end, the United States would surely come to an end in the form that we know it now, the American people would be killed. Because of this development of nuclear weapons and nuclear stockpiles, it now becomes only reasonable to give up war. We are forced now to abandon war as the way of running the world. We are forced to develop and to accept international law and justice in the solution of disputes between nations. I believe that we must all work to achieve this end. We must work to support our government in its effort to make international agreements leading to disarmament and control of nuclear weapons and the cessation of the bomb tests. We must work to see to it that the resources of the earth are used now, from now on, for the welfare of human beings all over the earth and not for death and destruction and the preparation for death and destruction. And I believe that we shall be successful.